Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, what few people understand about Martin Luther King Jr.'s life and philosophy. And first, how did corporations get civil rights? That's the question of our next guest. He says that the corporate rights movement began as early as 1809 with Alexander Hamilton's Bank of the United States case. That was followed by an advancement of corporate rights in 1882 when a former senator named Roscoe Conkling argued that corporations should get the same protections under the U.S. Constitution as people received. Despite the fact that the winning argument was built on falsehoods, it stuck. And since then, corporations have been winning rights that were meant for individuals who had been suffering without them. How did this corporate rights movement happen? What has it meant for U.S. politics? With us is Adam Winkler. He's a professor of law at UCLA and the author of books including Gunfight and his latest, We the Corporations. Welcome back to the Scholars Circle. It's great to have you here with us, Adam Winkler.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with Roscoe Conkling.
Well, Roscoe Conkling was an illustrious lawyer in the late 1800s who in the 1880s led a remarkable series of test cases on behalf of the Southern Pacific Railroad seeking expansive new rights for business corporations under the 14th Amendment. And Conkling had been a leader in the Republican Party in Congress for decades, had even been nominated and confirmed to the Supreme Court himself, but turned down the seat after being confirmed, the last person ever to turn down a Supreme Court seat after winning a confirmation vote in the Senate. Part of the reason was he was making too much money as a lawyer for the Southern Pacific Railroad. And Conkling went to the Supreme Court and argued that the 14th Amendment, which was adopted after the Civil War to protect the rights of the newly freed slaves, was also adopted to protect business corporations from discriminatory state taxes and regulations. And Conkling had unusual credibility in making this argument. Not only is he a person who had been nominated to the Supreme Court himself, but he had been a drafter of the 14th Amendment. And it turns out that historians now know that Roscoe Conkling had lied to the Supreme Court about the history of the drafting of the 14th Amendment.
But the court believed it. So deceit won here. And you said maybe this was because of personal factors. You think it's his relationships? What do you think that was?
Well, and strangely, the Supreme Court never ruled on Roscoe Conkling's case directly, held onto it for 3 years without ever issuing a final opinion. And then the case unexpectedly settled, which was odd because it was a test case designed to get a Supreme Court opinion. But another one of the Southern Pacific's 60 test cases, long before the NAACP was filing for their test cases to combat desegregation, the railroads were fighting test cases to win 14th Amendment rights for them. And another one of the Southern Pacific cases made it up to the Supreme Court a couple years later. And the Supreme Court eventually said that corporations do have rights under the 14th Amendment. And over the next few years would protect corporations far more than the Supreme Court would protect African Americans, the amendment's intended beneficiary.
One of the things that I thought was fascinating in your book was where you describe the process of gaining rights for corporations contrasted to how people have had to get their rights. So for people, it took mass mobilization. But this was not the case for corporation. It was a hidden movement. And then it co-opted the rights and the cases that were used for people to get their rights. How would you describe this process?
That's right. When we think about how women and racial minorities gained constitutional protections and gained equal rights, we have this idea of a sort of a civil rights movement, you know, where people march in the streets and they engage in public advocacy to win over the hearts and minds of we the people and to fulfill the promise of the Constitution. But of course, corporations don't march in the streets and they don't carry around signs demanding equal rights, but they have fought for 200 years in the Supreme Court, seeking landmark rulings extending fundamental constitutional protections to them. And in some ways, the corporate rights movement, if you will, has been more successful for a longer time than the civil rights movement or the women's rights movement. For instance, the first Supreme Court case on the rights of African Americans was decided in 1857. The first Supreme Court case on the rights of women under the Constitution was decided in 1873. But the first Supreme Court case on the rights of corporations under the Constitution was decided in 1809, a half century earlier. And unlike women and minorities who lost most of their Supreme Court cases up until the 1950s and 60s, corporations have amassed a remarkable track record of winning an ever-increasing share of our fundamental rights.
Another thing that I thought was fascinating that was a theme throughout your book was that political scientists, and I'm a political scientist, we have looked at Supreme Court decisions and looked largely at ideology as one of the major factors. You know, are they liberal? Are they conservative? But you've sort of busted that open and said that despite whether they are liberal or conservative ideologically, there's another ideology that really doesn't fit in this. How would you describe that?
You know, the truth is we think of justices in terms of liberal or conservative, but what unites justices over the course of American history has been that the courts largely been pro-business, whether the majority is liberal or whether the majority is conservative. And the history of the constitutional rights of corporations is a story of odd bedfellows, where it was sometimes liberal courts, like the New Deal and Warren courts of the early to mid-20th century, so the mid to the mid-20th century, that really invigorated the rights of corporations in a variety of ways. And oddly enough, it was Ralph Nader who won one of the landmark Supreme Court cases that really laid a foundation for Citizens United, which might seem the exact opposite of anything that Ralph Nader, the consumer rights advocate, would be seeking to achieve. And surprisingly, it was sometimes conservative Supreme Courts, like the business-friendly Lochner Court of the early 20th century, that imposed new limits on the rights of corporations and refused to extend to corporations rights of political speech and rights of freedom of association to turn down customers for businesses, some of the same rights that corporations seem today to be getting from the Supreme Court.
So let's break some of this down. One is the idea that some of these pro-business courts, like the Lochner Court. And another example that you gave in the book was the Roger Taney, who is awful for human rights, civil rights for people, but had some qualms about corporations having rights. And then there was the piece about Ralph Nader and how that's been sort of turned on its head. So let's start with the Lochner Court, Roger Taney. How does this make sense, if at all? And what was it that they opposed?
Between like 1890 and 1937 is a period in the Supreme Court's history that historians call the Lochner era. And the court was pretty business friendly at this time, building on Roscoe Conkling and the Southern Pacific Railroad's victory in winning 14th Amendment rights for corporations. The Supreme Court read the Constitution broadly to protect corporations from a variety of different kinds of business regulations. But the court back then did draw a line and a boundary on the rights of corporations. So corporations do have rights of property. They need to protect their property rights and their assets from being seized by the government. But at the same time, corporations don't have rights of liberty under the Constitution, rights that you might describe as associated with personal conscience or political freedom. And so back in the early 20th century, 100 years before Citizens United, the courts universally upheld restrictions on corporate spending in elections, saying that elections are not a place where corporations have rights. That's a liberty right. And 100 years before this year's Masterpiece Cake Shop wedding cake case before the Supreme Court on whether a baker can refuse to sell a wedding cake to a same-sex couple, the Supreme Court ruled that corporations could not claim a constitutional right to refuse to do service with certain kinds of customers. So at one point, some of the same issues that we see today came up before the Supreme Court long ago.
And then you mentioned Ralph Nader's case getting really essentially flipped around to rather than prevent the corporations from being able to trample on consumer rights, being turned to then grant corporations better rights. How did that happen?
Well, one of Ralph Nader's most remarkable and lasting achievements was a major Supreme Court victory in the mid-1970s in a case called Virginia Pharmacy. And what Ralph Nader did was, on behalf of consumers, was able to get the Supreme Court to strike down laws that restricted the ability of pharmacists to advertise the price of prescription drugs. And Nader was doing this not to help the pharmacists, but to help the consumers who wanted to be able to comparison shop but weren't allowed to get the access to the information that they would need. That case, however, adopted a very specific theory of the First Amendment, that because Ralph Nader was seeking to protect consumers, The Supreme Court said that the rights of listeners were valuable in the First Amendment. And regardless of the identity of the speaker and the rights of the speaker, that the consumers and the listeners of the information had rights that were protected by the First Amendment. That same theory would be used by the Supreme Court in Citizens United when it would say that the identity of the speaker was irrelevant, and the fact that a corporation was spending money on elections was not a basis to limit it, so long as the speech was valuable to listeners.
Now, if we were to back up and go into American history in the early days and how this came about, you've sort of challenged a narrative of what the founding of the United States was about, and you brought in the idea that really it was a pilgrimage of a corporation initially, the Virginia Company. How would you describe this, and what is the effect that you think it's had?
Well, we have the story that we are told as school children about the pilgrims who go to Plymouth, and they're sort of the perfect embodiment of the American spirit, resistance against tyranny, seeking to exercise their fundamental rights of religious freedom and self-governance, really a symbol of what America would become. But of course, the first permanent English colony in the New World was in Jamestown, 13 years before the pilgrims came. And Jamestown was a business affair. It was a money-making venture, a trading corporation, one of the Virginia Company of London, which organized the expedition and established the colony, was a business corporation that sold stock in London. And many of the reforms that the Virginia Company undertook, such as the first representative assembly in the 16 teens, was really not a progressive statement of principles of democracy, but it was a reform designed to encourage more people to move to the colony so that the company could make more money. So the profit-seeking corporation was as much a part of the founding of America as the pilgrims asserting their religious freedom and battle against tyranny.
And then you said the Constitution had roots in these companies.
One of the most surprising things I found is that there were clear linkages between our Constitution and the corporate charters of the early colonies. So many of the early colonies, like Jamestown, like Virginia, were organized around a corporate charter. The corporate charter was given by the king, and the charter would establish as a written document what the officers of the company could do, what the rights of investors were, when the investors could vote, what were the limits of the office holders' powers. And those documents became not just governing documents for the colonial corporations, but became governing documents for the colonies themselves as sort of political documents. And over time, as the colonies grew and evolved into more traditional kinds of government, they retained this connection to these written documents that clearly specified the powers of office holders and recognized things like individual rights and established things like the right to vote. So there's elements of our Constitution that really stretch back into our corporate heritage.
So that said, some of the famous founders were quite worried about concentration of wealth and power, Jefferson, Madison, George Mason in particular, but others were on the other side. Could you walk us through the debates at the time that related to corporations and corporate rights?
Well, there were significant debates right from the get-go. I mean, so when the founders debated the Constitution, they never considered whether corporations would have rights under the Constitution the way individuals do. It just never came up. It never was discussed. But the issue came up very quickly in the courts, in part arising out of a battle between Jefferson and Hamilton and their famous battle over the Bank of the United States. The Bank of the United States was established by Congress, but it was a private corporation with stockholders and amenable to the stock market, the stockholders. And the bank was the richest and most powerful corporation in America, with branches from Boston to New Orleans. And the bank and the dispute between Jefferson and Hamilton is famous for giving rise to the two-party system, but it also gave rise to the first Supreme Court case on the rights of business corporations, because Jeffersonians tried to tax the Bank of the United States in Georgia, and the bank wanted to challenge that tax in federal court. And so they went to court and said, we have a right under the Constitution to challenge Georgia's law in federal court, even though the provision of the Constitution that the corporation relied on was one that provided citizens with the right to sue citizens of other states in federal court. The corporation said it too was a citizen. And the Supreme Court, while it didn't say a corporation was a citizen per se, it did agree that corporations were protected by this provision And so from the very earliest days, the Supreme Court's been reading the Constitution broadly to protect corporations and their rights.
So then that developed down the line, and it challenged my understanding of corporations. I had always thought that corporations had to have a public purpose in order to exist, and that they were dissolved once that public purpose had been completed. And so your book suggests that even in the early days, there was this idea of longevity and that they could continue to exist, you know, beyond a normal person's lifespan. How can we understand these two conflicting ideas about what corporations were supposed to be in society?
Well, it's true that corporations were, from the get-go, designed to last. Corporations were first founded in ancient Rome, about three centuries before the birth of Christ, the first form of corporation that we recognize. It was sort of a response to the problem of partnerships. If you lose a partner, the whole partnership has to be reorganized, and it messes with business relationships. So the corporation was designed to create an entity where people could pool their money, and the entity would last over time. And it didn't matter whether the individual investors came or went, the company would go on. So that was part of the basic idea of the early Roman corporation. At the same time, the corporation was generally only allowed to be formed if it had a public purpose, as you say, that of course people could make money on it. The idea was to create a sort of outsource away from government into the private marketplace, the ability to build things and institutions, and corporations are very good at doing that. But you have to have some private investment encouragement to do that. But they always had to have a public purpose. That really changed, by the way, in a Supreme Court case decided in 1819, argued by the legendary advocate Daniel Webster, who won a Supreme Court case that said that corporations were fundamentally private entities and, like individuals, can make claims on the government for constitutional protection.
Well, since you brought up Daniel Webster, let's talk about some of the lawyers. You said that the corporations, one of their advantages was they could afford and therefore had the best lawyers in U.S. history. So tell us more about Daniel Webster, and then let's talk about some of the other lawyers.
Well, that's right. The Supreme Court is a place in which if you have the best lawyers, you're more likely to win. And over the course of American history, corporations have always had the financial wherewithal to hire the best, most creative lawyers in the entire country. If you think about civil rights organizations or women's rights groups, they often were underfunded. They didn't have the finances to continually bring lawsuits challenging every different kind of case for most of American history. But corporations did have those resources, and they hired the best lawyers. Daniel Webster was considered maybe one of the most influential advocates in the history of the Supreme Court. He argued more than 220 Supreme Court cases in the early 1800s, when many of the provisions were first being interpreted. He was known as one of the greatest experts on the Constitution, and most of his cases were brought on behalf of businesses and merchants, and some of his biggest cases were arguing for constitutional rights for corporations and for businesses. And all throughout American history, we see great lawyers playing a really starring role in the fight for corporate constitutional rights. And Daniel Webster is just a perfect embodiment, who was at the time, like I said, the highest paid lawyer in the country, and he could get corporations to represent him.
And there were others that you mentioned. I think one was a guy named Binney. Who was he?
Horace Binney was a young creative lawyer, a legendary lawyer, really, who grew up right across the street from George Washington in Philadelphia, back before the White House was built in Washington. And indeed, Hamilton lived right next door to him, so he grew up around power. And he, in his 20s, became a precocious young lawyer who ended up representing the Bank of the United States in that first Supreme Court case on the rights of business corporations. He was only in his 20s, but he was such an illustrious member of the bar, even at that early age. Binney would go on to live through the Civil War, in fact, and there's photographs of him right after the Civil War, an old man having seen America from its very earliest days to its much later days. But Binney had a creative way of thinking about corporations. He didn't say corporations were people. He said corporations were effectively irrelevant and that the court should look beyond the corporation and protect the rights of the people who associate together within the corporation. And surprisingly, for all the controversy over corporate personhood, Binney's basic idea of thinking about the corporation not as a person but as a pass-through has been much more influential in the history of constitutional rights for corporations.
Now, where would you put Theodore Olson?
Well, Ted Olson is today the dean of the elite Supreme Court bar in Washington. One of the reasons why corporations today are so powerful is that there is a professionalized bar in Washington, D.C. of big firm lawyers who all they do is specialize in Supreme Court practice. And studies show that those cases, lawyers who write those briefs are much more likely to get the court to accept their cases, and they argue an inordinate number of cases before the Supreme Court. And those lawyers predominantly represent big business and corporations, not small fry people and outcasts and dissenters. And so you have today the best Supreme Court lawyers in the country are lawyers who are arguing for corporations, for businesses on constitutional and other grounds. But it also shows, again, the power of the corporations to use the courts to protect their interests.
Did you see when you were writing this book that there had been a shift at a certain point that is significant? And I ask this partly because of, you know, Charles Epps' book, The Rights Revolution, where he talks about the shift from the 60s where the courts started to lean more toward individual rights. Was there a shift like this when it came to corporate rights, or was it consistent over time?
Well, I tell you, the story of corporate rights really is a thorn in the idea that rights talk is recent, because corporations have really been demanding rights and using the same language that we do in demanding rights as immunities from government regulation for a long, long time. And that's why corporations seek constitutional rights, right? Because they want to get immunities from taxes or regulations or other laws that interfere with business autonomy in their pursuit of profit. Of course, there are shifts. I trace a history that goes back to the first colony in Jamestown all the way through Citizens United and Hobby Lobby. So obviously, it's a time of remarkable change in both the nature of the corporation and the nature of our Constitution. But what we've seen is that whenever the Constitution changed to grant broader protections, corporations were always right there. Either they took advantage of those new rights quickly, like in the 14th Amendment context, or in some circumstances, corporations themselves were at the forefront of constitutional change, pushing and innovating the law to protect their own rights in ways that would ultimately filter down to individuals and benefit individual rights too. So it is a complex story of the push and pull of corporations and the Constitution.
Could you give us an example of some of those where it went the other way? So we've been talking more about the co-optation of certain rights that were granted to individuals, then given to corporations. But now you're talking about the initiator, the first mover, where then those got to translate into individual rights.
I think corporations are first movers in at least two ways in the history that I find. Number one, they devise and use innovative civil rights litigation strategies years before the movements for minorities and women do. Things like test cases and hiring all-star teams of lawyers, arguing for a living constitution that extends beyond the framers' intent to embody new principles. These kinds of things corporations were doing a long time ago. Corporations are also innovators in the sense that because they had the resources to challenge laws, they were often at the forefront of judicial cases that really breathe life into some of our constitutional rights. Take the freedom of speech or freedom of press under the First Amendment. Some of the earliest and most important cases were brought by newspaper corporations that were challenging restrictions on newspapers. And the Supreme Court, when it invigorated the freedom of the press, recognized that newspaper corporations had that same fundamental First Amendment right as individuals would have. And indeed, some of the landmark freedom of the press cases we still celebrate today are about business corporations. What is The Post, the super popular movie these days, if anything but a movie about a business corporation asserting its First Amendment rights?
So I wonder about this idea of agency and structure, which we argue about in social science. It sounds like in your book, you're arguing that it's really agency. These are people that are innovating and pushing to change the structure.
It's always a complicated mix of agency and structure, and that there's no one account that you should put all the emphasis on, especially as the author of a trade press book. You know, I've tried to emphasize a lot of the agency aspects because people love to hear the stories of the particular players. But of course, these are larger structural pressures as well. When corporations are seeking constitutional rights, obviously you need an individual person to make the decision to file that lawsuit. But it's because of larger structural reasons that corporations are pushing back, trying to assert their freedom so that they can pursue their profit. I do think it's a structural story too. And one of the structures is that the institutions of the judiciary, which we think of as being blind to the differences between litigants, and as a really equal playing field for any side in the dispute, is really one in which institutionally it's structured to help and benefit wealthy clients, and corporations are the wealthiest clients around. And so they've really been able to take advantage of those institutions to enhance their power.
I suppose part of that is also related to who ends up on the bench. And one key character in your book was Lewis Powell, who had been at the Chamber of Commerce before becoming a justice. How important is somebody like Lewis Powell or, you know, his brethren, people who ended up on the court in this construction of rights for corporations?
Well, of course, if you want to talk about a field of politics and life where agency really matters, take a body like the Supreme Court, where the vote of one justice really can make a huge difference in Americans' lives. And Justice Lewis Powell was one of those justices. Before he joined the Supreme Court, Powell wrote a memorandum on behalf of the Chamber of Commerce, arguing that it was time for corporate America to stand up and fight back against the rise of Ralph Nader and consumer rights and the environmental movement. And his memo became famous as a strategic document in the rise of the business backlash of the 1970s and 1980s. But he got the chance as a justice to implement his vision in the memorandum. There was an important case involving the political speech rights of corporations out of Massachusetts. And 30 years before Citizens United, Justice Lewis Powell wrote a closely divided 5-4 opinion for the Supreme Court saying that corporations did have political speech rights. And so that's an example of Justice Lewis Powell really having an influence and bringing his vision of the strong and powerful corporation with political speech rights into American lives.
So how is it that we have granted as a society, as an American society, all of these rights to corporations, but haven't really required the same kind of responsibilities? Does any of that make sense?
Well, it is true that we don't have the kinds of social responsibilities and political responsibilities that we've put on corporations that perhaps we should. And in fact, one of the things about corporate constitutional rights is that they often use them to shirk those broader responsibilities. So take an idea that businesses exist to serve the public and not to discriminate on the basis of irrelevant characteristics and create a second-class citizenship. It's one of the things that we really prize about businesses is that they're open to all and we have strong civil rights protections. But this year, the Supreme Court's going to hear this Masterpiece Cake Shop case on whether a Colorado baker has the right to refuse to sell a wedding cake to a same-sex couple. And if the Supreme Court rules in favor of the baker, it's quite possible we'll see more and more corporations claiming exemptions from civil rights laws and claiming the ability to discriminate against LGBT people and violating that basic idea of free and open access, the kind of responsibility to serve all equally that corporations have traditionally been thought to have.
You know, and that also extends to a case argued this year that dealt with whether or not corporations can be sued under certain statutes. And I'm thinking of the Alien Tort Statute at the moment in the Jesner case. And some of the appellate courts have said, no, you can't even sue them under the ATS. So there's this very strange juxtaposition between this, well, sure, we give them all these rights, but no, we can't sue them.
No, I think that's right. And that we're seeing in many ways corporations winning more and more rights and having fewer and fewer liabilities that they're responsible for. For much of human history, corporations were not allowed to be charged with crimes, for instance. But that changed about 100 years ago when there was a real push to say corporations are so powerful, they can form the kind of nefarious intent that the criminal law requires, and we should be able to target corporations when they engage in criminal activity and punish them. And so even back then, there was this idea that we need to hold corporations responsible, hold them liable. One of the things we found, though, is that even when you hold corporations criminally liable, what corporations did then was simply claim the protections of the Constitution's rights for criminal defendants. And we think of the Constitution as being about freedom of speech and freedom of religion, but it's also about the right to be free of unreasonable searches and seizures and a right to due process and a right against a right to counsel and a series of rights about criminal defendants. And corporations claim those same rights.
Let's fast forward to today. A lot of people on the rights front, particularly around campaign finance issues and election integrity, those types of things, have been talking about Citizens United. And there were two things about Citizens United that I thought were important. One was that the lawyer, you said, used Brown versus Board of Education as his inspiration. So I thought perhaps we should start there and then talk about what exactly that case did, if it wasn't really the turning point that others say it is.
Well, that's right. I mean, the lawyer who originally brought that case was a fellow by the name of Jim Bopp, and he saw Citizens United as part of a long pattern and series of cases that he was bringing to try to chip away at federal campaign finance law, at laws restricting money in politics, because he thought that these laws were restricting freedom of speech. And so he challenged law after law after law, and Citizens United was just the latest in a long line of cases brought by Jim Bopp challenging campaign finance laws. He was the one who said he was inspired by Brown versus Board of Education and that idea of bringing successive cases, chipping away at a dominant legal rule to change how the Constitution is interpreted. Again, it doesn't seem like, you know, it's an equivalent move to protect the rights of corporations and moneyed elites. But it was that same kind of rhetoric and the same framing by which he pursued that case. And Citizens United was an important and a groundbreaking case, holding that corporations have the same rights as individuals to spend their money on election ads. That's not equality by any stretch of the imagination. Very few individuals can afford the kinds of ads that corporations can easily and afford every day, filling up our television sets. So it's a kind of false equality. But I do think that Citizens United is the culmination of a 200-year fight for rights for corporations and should be understood in the context of that larger historical battle.
Let's conclude with what all this really means for democratic politics, for U.S. society, and where you think it's going.
Well, I think what this does mean for politics and society is another recognition of the ways in which corporations have asserted power and continue to assert power in the American political system. We often think of corporations as being powerful in the elected branches, in legislatures and among regulators and spending money on campaign finance and on lobbying. But corporations have also been remarkably powerful in the courts, using the Constitution to fight back against regulation. And if we want to understand the nature of corporate power, have to understand the way they use the courts and the Constitution to solidify and to magnify their power. And where are we going? I think actually we're in a period of rising and growing rights for corporations, from political speech in Citizens United, religious liberty in Hobby Lobby. Maybe we'll have this Masterpiece Cake Shop case could come out in favor of the baker, opening the door for more discrimination by businesses. I think we're at a time of real growth in the world of corporate rights, and we're going to see how it's going to affect society in the years to come.
Well, Adam Winkler, I thank you for joining us here again on the Scholar Circle. The book again is called We the Corporations. When we come back, the unknown or forgotten aspects of Martin Luther King's life and philosophy. Stay tuned. You're You're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. While much of the country remembers Martin Luther King Jr. as primarily a leader of civil rights and desegregation and a great orator, our next guests say he stood for so much more. But many aspects of his life, legacy, and philosophy remain either unknown or conveniently forgotten. We are joined by three experts. David Garrow is a professor of history and law at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. His publications include The FBI in Martin Luther King Jr., Bearing the Cross, Martin Luther King Jr. and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and he is co-editor of The Eyes on the Prize, Civil Rights Reader. Thomas Jackson is a professor of history at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro. He's the author of From Civil Rights to Human Rights, Martin Luther King Jr. and the Struggle for Economic Justice. Joshua Inwood is a professor of geography and Africana studies at the University of Tennessee. His publications include Searching for the Promised Land, Examining Dr. Martin Luther King's Concept of the Beloved Community, and Street Naming and the Politics of Belongings. Welcome to the three of you. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle. Thomas Jackson, you wrote in your book, From Civil Rights to Human Rights, that to understand Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. fully, we must understand who inspired him and whom he sought to persuade. Who did inspire him and who did he seek to persuade?
One of the theses of my book is that there's a remarkable consistency over his life course in the degree to which he thought that you couldn't really achieve racial justice without economic justice, and indeed without addressing issues of international peace. And that seems to be just a consistent thread throughout his life. First of all, his father and grandfather inspired him as sort of social gospel ministers dedicated to serving their communities. When he was in college and then graduate school, people like Howard Thurman, dean of chapel at Boston University, he was influenced by Reinhold Niebuhr, the socialist theologian in Detroit. His reading of Walter Rauschenbusch from the 19th century, a social gospel minister. This is sort of social gospel or even socialist Protestant thinkers and preachers. And that was quite formative. But there's a whole list of people, a whole group of them around Howard University who had been influenced by Gandhi as well, but also by egalitarian and revolutionary idea of Christianity. He sought to persuade everybody. He sought to persuade and bring together what you would need to produce a national reform constituency first, and then what he hoped would be a revolution of values. So principally, he was speaking to black communities to get them committed and mobilized for protest, and that was a rhetoric of black unity and Christian service. He sought to speak to the vast middle class majority, the electorate, in terms that would appeal to their sense of patriotism, but also fairness and justice, and in many ways their religious commitment to the least among them. And he sought to persuade policy elites. So he had a whole circle of advisors, and David Garrow knows a lot about this because he's unearthed a lot of it. But he sought to be an advocate, not only for civil rights legislation, but beyond that, for a robust war on poverty that would include things like job creation and free medical care on models that he saw in Scandinavia and Western Europe. He was also someone who self-consciously spoke to the world. I think if you look at his Nobel acceptance speech and his Nobel lecture, go to that and see the degree to which, as a kind of prophetic Christian leader, he thought that he really needed to speak to issues of international peace and economic distribution.
David Garrow.
The first thing for listeners to appreciate about Dr. King was that he was first and foremost a Baptist minister. King identified as a preacher. The Dr. King that you can hear in the recorded church sermons which have survived is almost always oftentimes a more powerful, more personal, more striking speaker than when you listen to King giving a civil rights talk at some college or university, for example. Both when he was in seminary at Crozer Theological Seminary, when he's in graduate school at Boston. As Tom mentioned, good many of the theologians and thinkers that he read during those school years, Reinhold Niebuhr in particular, had a significant impact on him. But more often than anything else, King is speaking from the Bible.
Joshua Inwood.
You know, as a geographer, I think one of the things that I find so interesting about King is he leads this movement that is arguably the most transformable to the spaces and places of the United States, at least since first contact with white Europeans with Native Americans. And I think the thing that you have to keep in mind with King, and I think when you think about King, is at his most basic level, he makes an argument for the way that we should live and connect with each other in the idea of community. And when I think about King and when I think about the things that really inspired him and some of the intellectual currents that he draws from that both Tom and David allude to in their work, it is that connection to space and place, which is very important to understand his transformative power as a social thinker and as a social revolutionary.
Josh Inwood, there's a concept that you articulated in one of your papers, which was the beloved community. How do you explain this?
As both David and Thomas talked about, King is first and foremost a Baptist minister, but King is also able to draw from both intellectual currents, European intellectual currents, and also currents within the African American community to really articulate a kind of idea of community that he talks about as the beloved community, which is really a space where all lives are interconnected and respected, and where he hopes you can transform individual lives through the transformative power of what he talks about as agape love. And so for King, he really makes distinctions between these three forms of love, between an eros, which is a kind of romantic love, philia, which is the kind of love and companionship that friendship has. But then he talks about agape. And at its most basic level, agape is the ability to tell your oppressor that what you're doing to me is not only wrong and dehumanizes me, but it also dehumanizes you. And so when King is articulating this notion of a beloved community, he is really talking and working and thinking about the transforming of these relationships, both black-white relationships, but also ultimately, as Thomas outlines in his book, you know, he's really building towards this economic argument that its final manifestation in the Poor People's Campaign. If you go back and you look at the Poor People's Campaign and what King was trying to do in 1967 and 1968, particularly in Washington, D.C., getting people to come to Washington, that is the manifestation of what that beloved community is. And there was a whole political program that was tied to the Poor People's Campaign, everything from a kind of guaranteed national income to universal health care, to also trying to get folks to understand and engage with one another in a different kind of level than had been going on in the 1960s in the United States.
This leads to an aspect that all three of you have discussed in your papers about the difference between the memory of Martin Luther King Jr. and the reality of it. Thomas Jackson, you wrote that we remember him, Dr. King, primarily as the leader of the civil rights movement that would end legal segregation. But really, his philosophy was so much broader and so much deeper than this memory of him. What more do we need to understand about the omissions to understand him? And why do you think we have these omissions?
We tend to freeze him in time and think that he didn't develop or address issues like the Vietnam War or like these deeper issues of poverty that revealed themselves to be so intractable after the Civil Rights Act. So we tend to remember and freeze him in time and identify him with the dream. In order to get a national holiday, the nation, I think, needed to arrive at a more of a consensus picture of who this man was. Even though Mrs. King, in the congressional hearings, said, "Here is your opportunity, nation, to make a national holiday and to celebrate a man who died in the service of labor rights for the sanitation workers of Memphis." But that is, as you suggest, occluded or elided in our consensus national celebrations, and nothing more evident than in the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. There are other communities, though, and you've heard of some samplings already, of people who remember different things that he said to audiences he was appealing to. Michael Honey, written a lot about King as a labor leader and who tried to forge a black labor alliance with so many unions. He didn't go on picket lines all the time, but rhetorically and in terms of his vision, it was very much one in which workers' rights and the rights especially to decent wages and collective bargaining protections were as sacred as the rights to life and liberty. So I think we don't remember that for the same reason that we have business pages of newspapers and not labor pages of newspapers. So there's a lot of contestation. I mean, a lot of people want to claim King as an opponent of affirmative action, or I got into an argument with his niece, whether he would have been a Republican today or not. So in order for the nation to celebrate him every year, there seems to be a least common denominator, but the richness of his activism and his life lives on, and you can see it in all these groups that try to keep his memory alive, especially the peace groups at the March on Washington, who were directly challenging the Obama administration's policies abroad in using King's words. There's a lot of debate and contestation within that legacy. It's not like it's a frozen or one-dimensional legacy.
David Garrow, you too have emphasized these omitted aspects. You actually used the word distorted in terms of Dr. King's vision. What do you see as the distortions?
I think most listeners are probably quite unfamiliar with how Dr. King sounded during the last 3 years of his life, 1966 to 1968. The King of those years was a very harshly spoken critic, not only of American foreign policy and the war in Vietnam, but of economic inequality here in the United States. And both in terms of what we can correctly label a democratic socialist economic vision that he's articulating those years, and how he, in very tough language, is denouncing the U.S. government's military behavior in Southeast Asia. King is a much tougher critic of the United States and American society than is really ever underscored at January holiday celebration.
Joshua Inwood, you haven't used the word distortion, but you noted some contradictions, particularly around this issue of militarism.
I very much agree with what David just said. King did not mince words when he talked about the triple evils of modern society, what he refers to as racism, materialism, and militarism. When he speaks to materialism, he's really thinking about kind of the unfettered capital accumulation that is both going on in the United States, but then also spreading throughout the world. And I think really if listeners want to get into this in a way and really try to understand how King had changed and how he had come to terms with American both militarism and capitalism, you really need to turn to his book, Where Do We Go From Here? Chaos or Community. And in many respects, this is King's most radical work. And King is unabashed when he talks about how American military soldiers who are standing in solidarity and burning villages in Vietnam would never be able to live on the same street in Detroit, Michigan. In many respects, you go back and you look at King in the 1960s, and we are still struggling and still trying to come to terms with many of those triple evils in society.
That's a perfect place to go into some of the struggles that he did face and the FBI surveillance of Dr. King. But let me first remind our listeners that you're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're talking with Joshua Inwood, David Garrow, and Thomas Jackson, who are experts on Martin Luther King. David Garrow, you've looked at the FBI's surveillance of Dr. King.
The FBI first began targeting Dr. King in 1962 and 1963 in the belief that he probably was being influenced by certainly one or more than one advisors who had previously been secretly active in and loyal to the American Communist Party in the early 1950s. So that hypothesis is what leads Robert Kennedy, as U.S. Attorney General, to authorize the wiretapping of Dr. King. The FBI, on its own, without any approval from the Attorney General, also begins using bugs as electronic recording devices, as distinct from telephone wiretaps, against Dr. King. And all of that electronic surveillance quickly leads the FBI into an entirely prurient interest in Dr. King's private life. So you have really incredibly distasteful government surveillance being targeted at King during all of the mid-1960s. But the FBI's surveillance of Dr. King was not unique. They were deploying even more electronic attention towards, for instance, the Nation of Islam, a quite small black sect that had really very little influence on anything. But the echoes of the FBI's behavior during the 1960s and early 1970s with the scope of government surveillance practices that we've all read about in recent months is a very, very powerful echo.
You mentioned RFK's authorization of the wiretap. How did the relationship eventuate between RFK, JFK, and Martin Luther King Jr.?
Both of the Kennedy brothers, from May and June of 1963 onward, were very strongly supportive of the civil rights movement and very actively in concert with Dr. King, notwithstanding what J. Edgar Hoover's FBI is consistently whispering in their ears. The same pattern then continues when Lyndon Johnson becomes president after John F. Kennedy's assassination. Johnson very courageously stands with King and the movement, especially in 1965, in putting forward the Voting Rights Act. But secretly behind the scenes, Johnson and scores of others know that the FBI is distributing and trying to peddle both these communist influence allegations and all of this detail about King's private life. But under the journalistic standards of the 1960s, nobody, television or newspapers, is actually using any of that FBI rumor. So there's a weird disjuncture between what people in government know privately and the public record of broadcast and news.
May I jump in here? It's Tom Jackson.
Yes.
I want to support that, but also, in perhaps a way, qualify or complicate it. I agree. I don't think King was. I think he might have been concerned and maybe a bit intimidated, but it didn't suppress what he was willing to go out on a limb on. And I think the work I'm doing right now in 1963 and 1964 suggests that King and a number of other civil rights leaders, while working in concert with Kennedy and Johnson, also tried to put pressure for more, especially for more robust economic policies, but also for more vigorous protection for civil rights and civil liberties in Southern voting rights campaigns where people were being murdered and brutalized. So that when David talks about King's radicalism from 66 to 68, I see that already in 63 and 64. And it's the FBI can't suppress things that he says. There's a speech when he returns from his Nobel Prize. And it's not the FBI, it's the New York Times that doesn't get the word out. He comes back. First of all, the Times quotes him as basically saying, "I'm returning with a conviction that nonviolence is the answer to the crucial political and moral questions of our time." Well, sitting there in the audience is Robert Wagner, mayor of New York, Vice President Hubert Humphrey, and later on that night, the same speech Malcolm X hears. What King actually says in this speech, and hasn't yet been published, is that before he went to Oslo, he thought the war on poverty, it's the 50th anniversary this week of the war on poverty. He thought it'd be a step in the direction of establishing economic justice, and he was encouraged by the Pope's powerful message on poverty after his visit to India, that nations really need to cease their armament race and devote themselves to assisting those who lack food, clothing, shelter, and medical care. He says, though, in Norway and Sweden, whose economies are literally dwarfed by the size of our affluence and the extent of our technology, they have no unemployment and no slums. Men, women, and children have long enjoyed free medical care and quality education. And he says, this contrast to the limiting and halting steps of the war on poverty, our rich nation is deeply troubling when more than 40 million Americans, white and Negro, live in grinding poverty. Today, that number hasn't basically changed a bit more. The poverty rate, ironically, is higher today. So he was speaking to these issues back in that era of civil rights reform and cooperation with liberalism. But the press wasn't picking up on the message. If you listen to the audio tape of him talking to John Kennedy immediately after the March on Washington, he and the rest of the civil rights leadership is saying, we need full employment. We need a jobs program. We need something much more vigorous than what you're offering. And Kennedy kind of deflects them and says, no, we need you to support the civil rights bill and to exert your influence on Republicans. So there is both cooperation and kind of challenge and conflict going on, even in that period, on these very issues that most people think only emerged later. They were already on the table in 63 and 64.
Joshua Inwood, let's put this into a geographic context. One way that you've looked at this is how memory has been created through, say, naming street signs after Martin Luther King and such.
There's kind of two ways to think about that. And we've talked a bit about the way that King is memorialized and the way that King is remembered. And the thing about memorials are, it's a way of concretizing an image. You can see that in the Washington, D.C. memorial, where you've got that image of King and that larger statue and the words that are inscribed in the monument. And it's really a kind of moment for us to think about and to recall certain aspects of King's legacy. But in recalling certain aspects of King's legacy, we are also forgetting other aspects of King's legacy. And so I think we always have to be a little bit careful when we start to memorialize leaders. And I think it's incredibly important where you have someone like King, who really is a social revolutionary, about how we kind of come to think about him and how we come to memorialize him. But I think it's also important to remember as well that King's work was only possible because there were thousands of others who were willing to not only take to the streets, but to do the hardcore political organizing that is necessary for someone like King and his mission and his activism to have success. We tend to think about King as just emerging here in the 1950s as kind of this great leader. But the reason he was able to emerge in the 1950s with the Montgomery bus boycott is because the political conditions had been created because of decades of struggle that had come before it. I think another thing that we have to keep in mind about King's legacy is there was also a very conservative African-American element that was as distrustful of King as some of the more radical elements in the African-American community. And so King is constantly buffered between these different aspects of the African-American community, these different parts of the African-American community, as he is trying to navigate this very complex political situation that presents itself in the 1960s in the United States.
Well, gentlemen, thank you for your work, and thank you for sharing it with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you, Maria.
Thank you very much.
It's been a great pleasure.
David Garrow is a professor of history and law at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. Thomas Jackson is a professor of history at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro. Joshua Inwood is a professor of geography and Africana studies at the University of Tennessee. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Anais Amin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.